We'll call the meeting of the Agriculture Policy Committee meeting to order. And just an announcement for those of you who may be here for the Representative Fabian bill. The parties want to discuss the matter further, so we will not be hearing the House File 1161 today. And I would urge the parties involved to get together, and I would like to be a part of that process. County feedlot officers, the Association of Minnesota Counties, and the MPCA to get together. And I would like to facilitate that meeting, and we'd like to get together and discuss some differences that have come up with that bill. So we will not be hearing House File 1161 this morning. Okay, thank you. We do have more bills to get to, and we do not have a quorum yet, so we can start to hear the first bill on the agenda, House File 257. Good morning, Representative Quam.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members.
Would you care to explain your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Basically, there have been some meetings with farmers I've had this summer, and discussions in past years where not all, but a few communities who have farms annexed in are treating them just as any other property within the city limits. The general process, the more predominant process, is have a special rural taxing district so they could be treated as ag property. And a lot of people, maybe, if you're not from the rural areas, you don't realize that when cities expand, they usually like to expand out to a road and a crossroad so that there's some continuity and access when they do develop. And so it's not uncommon to have one or two farms partially within the city limits. And sometimes this has gone on for decades, and property tax laws have changed and evolved. And now we have some situations where farmers are, a couple of farmers are paying 25% to 40% of all the property taxes within the city. And it's because, again, the farmland is being treated just as any other property. This would move to have those cities that don't have special rural service districts to implement them so they could more effectively utilize, ag rate for ag land. It is also pushed a little bit with discussion with the Farm Bureau and other groups. There's MPCA has been propagating down to smaller and smaller cities stormwater and other water issues, and some cities are looking at and implementing a fee by square area to cover costs of implementing the stormwater. Well, that's because on most town properties, you've got a roof, a driveway, a lot of paved areas that don't allow for the stormwater to soak in. Where the farm areas, there isn't that, and actually helps by having an area where you can have that water soak in, but they would still, if you don't have a special rural service district, be impacted by a fee. And so this would make it easier for the implementation of that activity without unjustly penalizing a group that actually helps out. So if there are any questions.
Representative, you and I have talked a bit about this bill offline. Is this a widespread situation that we need to address, or just how widespread is this situation that you're talking about? Which certainly is important.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this year I spoke with farmers from two small towns in an area that I used to have in my district before redistricting, and that's one county. I've talked with the Farm Bureau, and while this is not extensive, it is around most of greater Minnesota. You can have you know, an example or two in your district. And, you know, so again, it's not a large thing, but let's get everybody into the same, you know, general implementation of special service districts for the rural spaces inside towns.
Very good. We do have members present now to have a quorum. So would, Representative Nornis, would you care to take a look at the minutes for the meeting of February 25th, and if you so choose, to move to approve them?
Mr. Chair, they look good. I'll move the minutes of the 25th of February.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Minutes approved. And now we can move on to House File 257. Representative Rarick.
I'd like to move that House File 257 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections.
Okay. Any further comments, Representative Quam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Basically, this will go to property taxes, and that's where it would probably be either included in an omnibus or moved on separately. But I'm thinking that determination would be there.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Quam. I'm having trouble understanding what you're seeking to accomplish with this. I know what 2A and 2B ag land are, and I can picture that being within a city limit, but what will be the end result of creating these districts, whether it be with taxes or water quality standards, or what? How would this be applied?
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Johnson. For the vast majority of towns and cities, there would be no change because they already are utilizing it. For those that do not have it, they would, the impact is basically the farmland would be able to be treated differently than the rest of the city land because it is ag land. And it's easier to do that work if it's in a special service district. It's less convoluted. But the motivation for this is, one, the consistency, two, to be ready when the cities are implementing their stormwater to treat types of land appropriately, and three, to allow the ag land to be treated as ag land when its property tax is assessed within the city limits.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Quam, can you, because I'm new to this committee, can you explain the size for farmland in the city, ag land under 2A and 2B, and would community gardens be too small to be affected by this bill?
Representative Quam.
Thank you. I would think the staff and the ag committee would be better able to define how many acres and that type of type. But my understanding is that you probably wouldn't have a community garden reach sufficient size and area to be considered ag land. And generally, this is something you would see in greater Minnesota where you could have 40, 80, 100 acres of farm in the city limits.
Further question, Representative Schultz? Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question. I get a bit concerned when I see the must word in some things, and so the must be created. I know that I believe Representative Clark, not Clark Johnson, but Representative Karen Clark has brought forth a bill talking about urban agriculture and trying to, you know, and requiring cities to do something with regards to planning. So I'm just a bit concerned about the opportunity for local control and local initiative, that if you allow them to do something, maybe you'd have the local initiative to say, yes, we want to do that, and it would make sense. But by saying must, I just wanted to see about getting a response, Mr. Chair, on that terminology and that requirement and how that impacts local control.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Poppe. Basically, they've had the option to do this, and they haven't availed themselves over the years of that option. It tends to be not, frankly, our property tax system is fairly complex, and it isn't that conducive to have a long-term farm inside city limits and treat it as just regular city land. It's sort of counterinductive to the other property tax issues. So if they had treated it as farmland, then there wouldn't be the must. But frankly, it's probably the opinion of people that they're not doing what ought to be done. It's being exacerbated by some of the stormwater and other things that are percolating down to where you're penalizing somebody that's actually good. And frankly, I don't see a reason why a special rural service district could not include a garden. I don't know how you would treat it tax-wise, but if you're wanting to have different city treatment for stormwater or other issues, you could include that area in that service district. But again, it wouldn't maybe make the classification of 2A or whatever letter you want to put for the land. But it's just an appropriate way for the city to treat non-residential, non-normal business area.
Further question, Representative Poppe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can appreciate that if a city is annexing property and you're trying to make sure that it's accommodating for the type of property you're annexing. I guess I do have a concern about the must, because sometimes one size fits all just doesn't seem the best approach. And I'm always amazed, I've been here now in my 11th year, that local control is local control if you identify it as local control. But otherwise, local control changes based on different bills that come forward. And I just want to raise that as an issue.
Point well taken. Any further questions from members of the committee? Anybody in the audience who cares to testify on this house file? If not, Representative Rarick, would you like to renew your motion?
I'll renew my motion that House File 257 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections.
And it will have more stops. And by the way, there also was in your packet a letter of support on this bill from the Minnesota Farm Bureau. So Representative Rarick renews his motion that House File 257 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
And all opposed, same sign.
Nay.
The motion prevails. We have, I believe, some pages that just came into the chamber. And would you care to stand up and shout your name out and in what town you're from? We'd sure appreciate meeting you. Go ahead.
My name's Tom Nicholson. I'm from Edina.
I'm Rosemary Edward from Mora. I'm from
Welcome to the Ag Policy Committee. I think we may have a record for the furthest one coming from Turkey to one of our committee meetings. Well, very good. We have a couple other bills to get to, and we will get ready for that now.
Representative Anderson, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 1235 to be referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices.
All right, Representative Anderson, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I've been around here for, I guess, not as long as Representative Poppy, but for this is my seventh year, and this topic has come up every year, I think, in the Ag Committees. It has to do with raising the ceiling on a very popular and successful program, the Farmer Lender Mediation Program. And the ceiling on the number in a loan that would require mediation was set back in the 1980s at $5,000. And ever since that time, that threshold number has not been changed. And we're all aware of what's happened in agriculture in terms of inflation, higher prices, things like that. So there's been a movement quite often in this committee to increase that number. And for a variety of reasons, it hasn't. And those reasons, I think, are valid. But we just think it's time that we look at this anyway and to look at the possibility of raising that number. And some statistics that I've received, 2012, the average ag debt was $140,000, and in 2013, the average debt had increased on the farmer lender mediation side now to $161,000. So, again, because of the length of time this number has been in effect and because of inflation and such, we feel that the time is right now to increase the number that would set the threshold for the automatic mediation process. And I'd have to add that a lot of banks and lending institutions are doing these things anyway. And we don't want any loans to end up in default, those types of things. And institutions do what they can to make sure those things don't happen. So with that, Madam Chair, I would stand for questions.
Okay. Does anybody have any questions? Yes, Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair. And Chair Anderson, I guess I'm also hearing that there are still farmers, beginning farmers, immigrant farmers who need that lower threshold. And I think if we're really going to try to be for all farmers, we shouldn't neglect those who have that need. And so I guess I would speak against the change. And I'm wondering, are you aware of farmers who tell you that this isn't a need, that we don't need to keep this in place? I mean, I think we do need to extend the farmer lender mediation program, but I still think it's premature to make this change at this time, and I know of the ups and downs of agriculture, and I'm concerned about changing that threshold.
Mr. Chair, Paul Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, I have not had a lot of farmers talk to me one way or the other about this program. I was doing some research on this as well, and I agree with you that there are a new generation of farmers that this may apply to, but there are also some other aspects of the program, and it says the notice also advises the debtor that they have a right to mediation on a secured debt of more than $5,000 against the ag property if the debtor owns or leases 60 acres of land or has $20,000 in gross sales of ag products. So because of that added stipulation, I really wonder if we're talking about some of the smaller farmers, if they would meet that criteria. And because of that as well, I think that we would be appropriate in raising the number to a certain higher level.
Representative Bly.
I guess thank you, Chair, and Chair Anderson. I think maybe the other thing to consider is that although there may be those who think that the threshold should be raised, it might be better to, if a farmer is finding the beginnings of problems earlier on, before it gets to a larger debt problem, they could enter into that mediation. Having the trigger lower makes that possible. And I think trying to solve the problem before it gets out of hand may be better.
Well, I agree, and
Representative Anderson.
Sorry, Madam Chair, but I also think that a farmer or the person who has a debt, it would behoove themselves on their own to go into the banker and say, "I may have a problem here," and wouldn't have to use this process at that lower level that you're referring to. And you know, bear in mind that with inflation, the price of land has increased, and $5,000 in some areas wouldn't even buy an acre of land anymore. So, again, based on inflation and such, we just feel that to make the number more appropriate to today's ag conditions, the number should be raised. And I'm not totally hard and fast on in the bill here. We're talking $75,000. That number would be up for negotiation. I certainly am not going to fall on my sword over the $75,000 figure, but I do think it needs to be raised to some level.
Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair, and Chair Anderson. I did try to attempt to get an amendment in that would restore the $5,000, and I guess I'm not sure exactly how we would negotiate a lower figure or what would be appropriate, but I still am concerned about making sure that this policy, which is in place to help farmers, continues to help farmers, and that we're not making the change for some other reason. It's unsettling to me that we would, without really looking more carefully at what that number, that appropriate number ought to be, that we let this go forward. So, and it's not really appropriate to have that discussion here in the committee necessarily, but I'm troubled by the fact that there may be a better number, or there may be farmers who are not taken care of under this change.
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, again, according to figures that I was given from at least the letterhead here is University Extension, the average farm debtor recorded in mediation was a 55-year-old sole proprietor ranging in age from 25 to 83 who had owned land for 24 years, owning 328 acres, renting another 380, averaging agricultural debt of approximately $161,000. And again, for the average person in this program, the number is far higher than $5,000.
Okay. Representative
Bly. I don't have any more questions at this time.
Representative Poppy. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Chair Anderson. A couple of comments, and maybe I would concur with Representative Bly that I'm not sure that $75,000 is the amount, and maybe you also would agree to that. I know that I had the opportunity this last year of doing the civil mediation training. I think we all kind of get offered that. We get a postcard that says, you know, we could do that, and I took the opportunity to do that. And, you know, it's just well worth the time to be thinking about how to resolve issues without getting too contentious, you know, and to try to do mediation as a first step, or maybe it's somewhere in the midpoint, but you're trying to do it so that you're allowing for a resolution that is agreeable to all sides. And so I think, you know, as we previously talked in committee about the raising of the level or not raising of the level, I think at the time that I carried the bill last year or 2 years ago, we did have the University of Minnesota Extension come and kind of give us the details. I appreciate that you have the average, but I'm thinking that maybe the outliers are a little bit about who we're trying to make sure they get to be part of this process. And that's why, I don't know if anyone's here from the University of Minnesota Extension to be able to talk about that, but I think it's the outliers. It's the people that are the first generation farmers, not the, you know, or the immigrant farmers, or, you know, some of those people. So anyway, I'm wondering, maybe we can hear from Extension about that. And I do think maybe we should be talking about, you know, if you're going to increase it, what is the threshold? Is that is $75,000 the right, or is there a lower amount that maybe still captures most people but doesn't put it too high?
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, yes, to Representative Pompey's good comment. I believe university people are here, and they will comment on the whole range of people served by this, so I think you will hear that.
Okay, members, I'm going to ask you all to hold your questions, and we're going to move to the testifiers, so if that's all right, thanks. And up we have Joe Witt. I believe, Joe, you're ready?
Yes.
All right.
My name is Joe Witt. I'm the president and CEO of the Minnesota Bankers Association. Our association represents 95% of the banks operating in the state of Minnesota, from the biggest to the smallest. We have a lot of ag banks within our membership. Looking at the statistics, again, provided by the University of Minnesota Extension Service, which is the group that administers the mediation program, 48% of the mediation notices came from the banks that we represent. 62% of the debt covered by the mediation notices also came from our bank. So we're a big part of the lending community that's covered by this farmer lender mediation bill. I've worked for the association since 1996, and when this bill was first passed back in 1986, it had a two-year sunset on it. It was a program that was designed to serve an immediate need where there was an emergency crisis within the ag community. Every 2 years after that, it has been extended, so I've been part of a lot of these discussions as well, trying to figure out whether the program should be extended first and foremost, and then if it should be extended, whether there should be any changes to it. Our association does believe that this limit should be increased. The $5,000 number has been in place, as we said, since 1986. And right now, in with land prices the way they are, it does cover about a half acre of land in southwestern Minnesota and different parts of the state. It is a fairly low threshold that would trigger this mediation requirement. We would support an increase. To some of the questions that were asked with respect to where this mediation notice falls within the process, it is sort of at the tail end of the relationship that a lender has with the borrower. The step of sending this notice right before you go into the foreclosure process is very late in the game. But I can assure you that our banks are working with people all the way through the process. In agricultural credit, as you all know, some people have longer term debt associated with their real property. A lot of other farmers have revolving lines of credit that are renewed on an annual basis. The banks and the borrowers know where they sit in their relationship with the lender. They know whether there's going to be problems on the horizon, and they're anticipating those issues. When we see land prices go up, when we see commodity prices going down, I can assure you that the lenders are very well aware of those general trends, and they're looking at every single relationship they have to see how things are going to be performing in the years ahead. When there are problems, I can guarantee you the lenders are on top of it. That is their business. They do a very good job of it. One of the things we value about the farmer lender mediation program is that there are some times when the lender wants to reach out to the borrower, but because of their financial situation, they've pulled back a little bit. They haven't necessarily engaged. They haven't necessarily acknowledged that there are some of those issues involved. So in a lot of cases, the farmer lender mediation program gives the lender and the borrower a good opportunity to sit down and work out some of those differences. So we value the program, but we do think that threshold is just a little bit low. We are working with people at every stage of the game to try and make sure their loans are performing and try and make sure that they're successful in their operations. It isn't just at this very late stage of the game that we want to talk to them. We're talking to them all along. We definitely support an increase. We thought the 75,000 number was a good one, given the fact that we have those averages. We understand where those average numbers are. I'd be happy to, you know, talk about where those outliers are, where those outer limits are as well. But we definitely support an increase. And as I said, 75 looked pretty good to us.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Witt. Next up, we have Mary Nels Pressler.
Madam Chair, could the university would like to hand out some information?
Sure. Thank you. Ms. Pressler, if you would state your name and all that for the record, it'd be great.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Mary Nell Pressler. I'm the Program Director for the Farmer Lender Mediation Program with the University of Minnesota.
Okay, please proceed.
Madam Chair and the committee, today I'm here to talk about a program that I hope your farmer constituents never have to use. But it's important in today's agriculture that there is a process like this to use when things don't work out. Farmer lender mediation helps farmers and lenders work out solutions for managing agricultural debt. It is part of the USDA's certified state agricultural mediation programs nationwide that gives farmers and their creditors the opportunity to renegotiate, restructure, or resolve farm debt. The national program was reauthorized as part of the recent federal farm bill. Minnesota has a program that will sunset June 30th of 2016. How it works. A creditor with a secured debt of more than $5,000 against agricultural property must offer farmer lender mediation before proceeding with foreclosure, repossession, cancellation of a contract, or collection of a judgment. That's when Extension gets involved with our team of mediators and financial analysts. The first step is an orientation meeting if the farmer chooses to take advantage of mediation. The farmer, creditor, financial analyst, and the mediator meet to explain the process and to determine if financial information needs to be prepared. Successful mediation consists of two things: neutrality on the part of the mediator and compromise on both the part of the debtor and the creditors. Farmers may have to change their operation to make it profitable or liquidate assets. Creditors may need to restructure debt or security or reschedule loans. The mediator leads and manages discussion as a neutral party without making decisions or judgments. The mediator does not take sides or decide how the dispute should be resolved. If mediation does not resolve an agreement in 90 days, the parties are free to pursue whatever course of action is available to them. Most often with a clearer understanding of the facts, the issues, and the positions of the other parties. Extension manages the process as part of our commitment to farmers and rural communities. The program has proven to be an asset to individuals, businesses, and communities affected by the loans that are mediated. There's an executive summary in your folders, and that is from last year's executive summary, and that has changed. I believe the executive summary that may have been used prior was from 2012. This is 2014. So in last year, there were 1,680 mediated cases. However, in the first 5 months of this year, we have an 81% increase. That will be on this piece of paper in your folder. And there's another one with some statistical information. Jim Anderson will go through that to tell you what's happening in the first 5 months of this year. We can hardly compare it to last year. I know at the very beginning of this year, many creditors were telling me to be prepared because it's going to increase. It has increased in the first 5 months dramatically. because some of this has been addressed already that I have in my notes, I am going to talk about the way the program is administered. The program operates very efficiently with three full-time staff, a program director, and two administrative support staff. All others involved, the University of Minnesota staff, mediators, and financial analysts, are part-time and work as needed. As we look forward, we know the current economic picture points to uncertainty and trouble. Based on current economic conditions, we are seeing an increase in cases. Over the past 5 months, the number of new cases we receive is up over the same period of last year. We're working 359 more cases in February of 2015, which comes to 802, than in February of 14, which was 443. Jim Anderson is a financial analyst with our program, and he is going to speak to the amount of the increase and who is being serviced. In 2009, the subject of the threshold amount of $5,000 of debt secured agricultural property was addressed, and the thought it should be changed. It was decided at that time to leave the threshold at $5,000. This is a summary of some of the reasons for leaving it. State policy encourages beginning farmers. Beginning farmers often have smaller operations and smaller debts, but they would benefit from the farmer lender mediation as they are developing their farm business management skills. There has been a rise in the number of immigrants and socially disadvantaged farmers in Minnesota, many of whom supply fresh vegetables, fruit, flowers to local markets, and many who have debts of under $5,000, but below the average debt of the Minnesota that has been quoted to you. All agricultural property is essential to most farms. If the initial problematic debt is not addressed in mediation and the property is repossessed, liquidated, then it will be harder to resolve the remaining debts and restore positive cash flow. Increasing the threshold amount would mean more cases would end up in bankruptcy and in our already seriously overburdened state court system. With me is Elaine Benston. Elaine is a mediator with a program who has worked with several Hmong families. And I would turn that over to her for right now.
Ms. Benson, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Elaine Benson, mediator for the Farmer Lender Mediation Program. Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. As a mediator for the Farmer Lender Mediation Program, I will tell you that each case that I've been involved in is quite unique. They range from very experienced farmers to beginning farmers, from large farms to underserved farms. The program has been accepted by the Amish, Hispanic, Native American, and other producer groups. I would like to tell you about one case in particular. In this case, the farm was a ginseng farm owned and operated by a Hmong family. This family had a very successful history in the production of ginseng, but were also new farmers to the state of Minnesota. After being denied payment by the non-insured crop disaster program, this family requested mediation. Farmer lender mediation was offered to them by the County Farm Service Agency. The county committee's denial determination was decided after reviewing paperwork submitted by the family and after visits to the farm by the program loss adjuster. I determined during our first mediation session that a Hmong English language barrier existed between the two parties. Therefore, our future meetings included several parties. Mary Nell Priestler appointed a language interpretation service, an advocate from the Farm Advocate Program, and representatives from the Farm Legal Action Group helped to represent the family story to the USDA representative. After two meetings with this group, the County FSA Committee took into consideration the Hmong English language barrier and the staff's inexperience with ginseng production and rescinded their previous determination. The farm, in fact, was eligible for non-insured crop or disaster program benefits. Because of this three-meeting mediation, this family maintained their farm and their livelihood. The Minnesota USDA and the FSA committee, county committee, expanded their knowledge of this non-traditional crop.
Then we have Jim Anderson, or sorry.
Ms. Pressler?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Okay. Then we have Jim Anderson. He is a financial analyst with the program. And there are two handouts in your packet that have numbers on them. And Jim will explain some of those. And we've done our research to see what would be the impact upon which people, which farmers, if we raise this $5,000. Because, yes, I know this has been in effect since 1986. Yes, and it has been discussed before in the past to raise it. But who are we targeting to have this program in the first place? And so we have done, we have current information. It says current as the end of the month, the 28th of February. That's current. And so we have this current information showing you what the impact of raising the $5,000 threshold would be.
Jim?
Okay. It's Mr. Benson. Jim? Please state your record and proceed. But just before that, though, we've got two more testifiers, and we'd like to see this bill wrapped up by 11:15. We still have members from the committee before we vote. Go ahead, Jim.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee.
Please state your name for the record.
James Anderson. Madam Chair and committee, this is the sheet I'm referring to. I did this as a workbook just for my own benefit this morning and thought I'd bring it along. And basically, it breaks out the percentages of notices by the amount of debt. It's kind of hard to understand, so it might take some explanation. The columns on the left are the amount of debt. For example, the $5,000 would have had 74 notices. If you carry that down to the 15,000 number, the sum of those three debt amounts would yield 389 notices. To increase that notice amount from 5,000 to 15,000, you would be eliminating 29% of the people that get notices. If you would increase it to 75,000, you'd be eliminating 72% of those people. I've been a mediator since the 80s when the program began. And I think really the original program was meant for these people in that lower part of that graph that I have, that chart. Also, just one more comment and I'll be done here. The numbers have gotten so big on the top side, it's hard to come up with an average. People don't typically find a solution for a land problem in mediation. It's more a solution for staying in business one more year. So these huge numbers, these huge land values, really don't affect what our program is all about. And also one more comment. This program is not meant to keep a farmer farming at all costs. We provide information and education. We're not here to try and, we're not advocates. We're not here to try and convince somebody to bury themselves up to their neck in sand. So So, but having said that, Madam Chairman, I guess that's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Next up, we have David Skilbred of the Independent Community Bankers.
Madam Chair, members, my name is David Skilbred. I'm the Vice President of Government Relations for the Independent Community Bankers in Minnesota. About 300 banks across the state in urban, suburban, and rural areas. And the ag industry is one of two of our biggest niches that we take part in. And those loans are very important to us and the families and farms behind them. One person said that we're connecting with these people in trouble anyway, and that's really true. Community banks have a characteristic of relationship. Their banking is a relationship type banking. We are not making widgets trying to turn out more and more paperwork in order to increase profits. We have relationships with our members, often over many, many generations, and we want to see them succeed. We will find out most of the time if there's a problem developing, and we'll go out and reach out to those folks. It's been kind of implied that no resolution will take place unless there is mediation. And I don't think that that is the case. And I'll make this short because I know you're running out of time. The last testifier referred to notices and how many of those there were. And as I recall, the testimony from the U of M is that the notices are sent to every person who owns a piece of the farm. So if four brothers farm together, they get four notices, but that's really only one case. So the number of cases are far lower. And lastly, I don't have that sheet in front of you, but my strong feeling is that if you look at the numbers of cases that were resolved, there are a very small percentage of those cases which began. And that's because some of them drop out in the middle of the resolution, you know, the mediation process. I'll stand for questions and end right there.
Actually, Mr. Skilbred, we're going to go to the next testifier. Okay. All right. Thank you, though, for your testimony. Next up, we have Tom Peterson from the Minnesota Farmers Union.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union. And we do support the part of the bill that extends the deadline. Appreciate Representative Anderson doing that. And I have talked with him about some of our concerns about the bill. We do oppose raising the threshold and have historically. We feel that the program's working. I look at the numbers. I look at 73%, you know, reaching a settlement. I look at where this program is used. I think that's another thing. I think you have one of the handouts from the university shows, too, and where it's going to be used. I always think, you know, agriculture is so cyclical. You know, crops can be doing good one year, and we're doing great, and then our dairy goes down, and then dairy goes better crops. It's be great someday if we ever get it all working together. But, you know, if you look at the southeast up to my area in east central Minnesota, west, southwest, not surprised, central Minnesota, 28% of the cases, east central Minnesota, 16% of the cases, and then southwest, you know, 4%. It really goes with farm size, too, I think. I've always thought that about the program. And, you know, because $5,000, we talk about it, what is it? You know, some places you can't even buy a tire on a combine for $5,000 or a set of, you know, and so that is, you know, very interesting. But I think looking at that, it is important to look at those numbers. I always think about people who call me, because that's what we do as a farm organization. Our members call us when they're in trouble, and they kind of talk through the whole situation. Those are hard calls to take. You know, I take them right now. I can think of three farmers that are in mediation right now, and most of them are in the $100,000 range, you know, and it's hard to get them to talk about it, and it's an important program. But there are some that we've worked with that are in that lower range, and it really depends on your type of farm. A $15,000 tractor to a new cow-calf operator, somebody who's farming with another farmer, can be a big deal. That can be, if something goes bad, a lot of times it's health. Their health, they lose their job, or they're farming part-time, or trying to go full-time, or starting out. And I just think of some of these cases that we're going to take, you know, even just going 1,000, it looks like 1,000 notices if you look at from 75,000, but even from 25,000, that's 547 different claims. A lot of those are the same person, but you know, that's going to be a lot of farmers in your districts by doing this. So we're saying we're not going to offer them that chance anymore. We're going to say, you know, take your chance, go in, work with your banker, and they're going to work with you. And that's what I heard earlier today. And yeah, that works a lot. I've been in that situation, but I've also been in the situation where it doesn't work. And so we have this for those people. You know, we talk a lot about beginning farmers. How do we get people farming? Here's a program we have that keeps people farming and works to keep people farming. And so I just urge you to consider either keeping it at 5,000 or a much more manageable number. One other thing I want to mention is I also talk with farm advocates, and I don't know if a lot of you know, but we fund farm advocates in Minnesota. It's another person, and it's a good group that we have around the state. And I asked the farm advocates, I said, yeah, that 5,000 deal, is that a big deal? Can we raise that or lower that? Are there people that will go out of business because we're going to raise that? And they'd say, yeah. Almost every one of them would say, yeah, there's going to be people that's going to hurt if we raise that limit. And so we want every farmer we can keep. And here's a program that helps that, and I urge your consideration on that piece. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. I do have a lot of young farmers in the Ashby area, too, so I thank you for bringing those points forward. Members, we're going to open it up for questions. And first up, we have Representative Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It looks like from the data here, I mean, because my question initially was how many farmers might be affected by this, so we have clear data here. And I don't believe that the informal, like the testifier was saying, that the informal negotiation process, even though that's an important first step, but that's always the first step, and that it's not an adequate substitute for mediation, and we could talk about that. You mentioned some of that. And in some cases, there may be good relationships. In other areas, there may be not so good relations. I'm curious as to the what problems this is addressing. So if it's lender driven, the problems that lenders, is it cost? It looks like there's a high number of cases that fall under 75,000. We know that mediation is the most effective way. It's more effective than litigation, less costly. But how many of, because really what this bill will allow is for the creditor to take action earlier to enforce a debt. And so, and I know that we're looking at our foreclosure laws, and it's very easy to foreclose through non-judicial, through advertisement, and is that less costly? So I think that there's got to be other ways to address maybe that mediation program needs, it's inadequately funded or not enough staff, or that identify some problems that the lenders are having that could be addressed by means other than eliminating this program.
Mr. Peterson, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will attempt to cover some of the things you brought up. I'm not speaking for the bankers, but I would assume that the reason for this looking to increase the number is just to basically keep up with inflation. This number was put into effect, again, back in the 80s. And I understand, I get it, that we still have a lot of newer, younger farmers. But I think there's a process in place anyway, and mediation is kind of a culmination of this entire process of if there's a loan that's in trouble. And I just have some more numbers here. That the creditors sent out 1,612 mediation notices, and of that total, 26% requested mediation. So not all the notices that go out wind up in mediation either. Some of them are settled in other methods. So just to comment on your point that, again, it's just to keep up with inflation.
Mr. Peterson.
Madam Chair, to that point, the price of corn today is, way down. It's not much higher than it was in 1986. We go in these cyclical natures, and we see prices. I've seen some forecasts where it's going to go. It's below, or about what we were in 1996. That's the concern. Milk prices were high. Now they're heading south fast. And so I think that I worry about the inflation argument myself on the other flip side. So,
okay. Members, we're just going to, if you could keep your questions brief and to the point so we can wrap this bill up. Representative Rerich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Anderson kind of brought up what I was going to ask. Of the 1,680 notices that were sent, and we have those statistics where they lie, 520 went to mediation. I think we need to know where those numbers lie to get a better idea of who is actually being helped by mediation. Is that a number that we can get, the 520 actual mediation cases? What income level or what debt level did they serve?
Representative Hamilton, you want to address that? Does any other previous testifier have an answer to Representative Rerich's question?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Pressler.
And Representative, yes, we have very complex record system where I could tell you, if not today, but I can certainly look it up to see what was the triggering amount for the 520 for last year. That's definitely data that we need to supply for some of our federal aid that we get.
Okay, Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair. I just, I have a great deal of respect for community banks and appreciate the good work they do. Perhaps if more banks were like community banks, we might not have had the problems that we had in 2008. But I think there's a difference between impartial mediation, where you have someone involved who isn't representing either side, and the importance of that mediation is clear to me. And I think we don't want people to fall into problems because they didn't have that opportunity to get into mediation. The other thing that struck me in the testimony by the testifier was that there's education that goes on, and early on, when you have that lower loan amount, that you can help that farmer prepare for struggles as they occur. And I guess, Chair Anderson, I know that in the rules for the committee, it's possible to change the rules, and I would feel a lot more comfortable. I know this bill is going to go somewhere else, but if you could entertain the amendment that I would have offered that would have returned it to the 5,000 so that this conversation can continue, I think there's enough anxiety about among members that perhaps we shouldn't let it go forward without really looking more carefully at these numbers and what the right number might be.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To that point and to all the testimony that's been given this morning, I respect it. And we want to get this right before it leaves our committee. So, Madam Chair, I would entertain a motion to hold the bill over and to work with all those interested and involved in this and come up with the number that may be more appropriate or maybe, in fact, to leave it where it is.
All right, Representative Anderson, if you wish to lay the bill over, that's what we will do. And the bill is laid over.
Thank you.
Could you get us some
The next bill on the agenda is House File 582. Representative Anderson, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 582.
And re-refer it to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices?
That would be correct.
Okay. Representative Anderson, please proceed.
I'm still shuffling paper here, Madam Chair. Yeah, House File 582 addresses an issue that sometimes can be quite contentious. And going back in history, the Pollution Control Agency has tried to set standards and such for emissions, noise, odors, things like that. Going back to 1967, the legislature mandated the PCA to adopt some statewide standards for noise and also air emissions. And they did that in 1986 and again also in 1982. But because by 1997 they had not adopted any statewide air emission standards for livestock odor, the legislature then adopted the statewide hydrogen sulfide standards as a substitute, if you will, for statewide livestock odor standards. And this was the legislature's attempt to compromise between feedlots that smell at times, and also their neighbors who have the need for living without unreasonable odor interference. And this established an objective standard with which the feedlots had to comply, but the government and the neighbors could enforce if the feedlot did not measure up to that standard. But we need to clear up some loose ends and make the standard adhere to some objective standards, and that's what this bill attempts to do, Madam Chair. I'll stand for questions.
All right. Representative Anderson, we're going to move through the testimony first and then open it up for questions. Mm-hmm. Sorry. So next up we have Jack Perry.
Madam Chair, Jack Perry, I'm a lawyer with the Briggs Morgan Law Firm, and just to go back a little bit to where Representative Anderson started, is the dates are critically important to understand this bill and why these amendments are in front of you. In 67, the legislature was very clear. They directed the PCA folks who are up here, said pass noise standards and air emission standards, which they did in the 80s. But the problem with livestock odor is it's difficult to measure and find which contaminant, which emission to measure for livestock odor. And so the PCA was unable to do that scientifically. 97 and 2000, the DFL, I think DFL was in control of both the House and the Senate, and they wanted to come up with something, and the irony is that it was driven by neighborhood activists who said, we can't live in a situation where we don't have standards to use to force upon feedlots and facilities to make sure they are in compliance. The neighbors wanted standards, and the DNR, the University of Minnesota, and the MPCA all said, yes, we need to quantify it. And the compromise that came out of that legislation in 1997-2000 was that we were going to adopt, in Minnesota, and did adopt, an imperfect science. We adopted hydrogen sulfide as the proxy or the standard for livestock odor, because otherwise you have 300 different contaminants you'd have to measure, which would be impossible. So that's what the legislature did in 1997, and then they reinforced that in 2000. And I know firsthand, representing some of these feedlots, that the system has worked. 4 years ago, Mr. Reitz and I went at it at a facility who was out of compliance, as found by the court, and PCA came after him and said, these standards that were adopted in 97, you're out of compliance. Gave my client time to come into compliance, couldn't do it. That client doesn't operate, that facility doesn't operate. The system works. More recently, back in July of 2013, the case that kind of brings this to a head, a multi-million-dollar facility opened up in Todd County. Started in July of 2013. Immediately, neighbors said it smells, and they complained, consistent with this law, to Mr. Reitz and the folks at the MPCA. They immediately, pursuant to the existing law, said, we're going to monitor at the boundary, which they did. And they found they were in compliance. That should have been the end of the story based upon the law. Because if there's not an exceedance, there is by law, because these standards are set at nuisance levels, health risk levels, by their own rules. That should have been the end of it. But the reason we're here today is that's not the end of it. Instead, what has happened is various groups have been pushing to change the interpretation law that has existed for the last 20 years, last 18 years to be precise. And the interpretation now is, well, we don't really care what you folks did in 1997, 2000. We don't care about this compromise because that law only applies to one person in this room, and that's the MPCA. It doesn't apply to the neighbors, doesn't apply to the facilities or local governments that they want to try and enforce it. It only applies to regulatory enforcement actions by the MPCA against feedlots. Well, that doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense because you guys added in 1997-2000, one of the major things you did was you not only created standards and said they applied the property line, and you said we're going to use hydrogen sulfide standards as the proxy for livestock odor, but the most critical thing for the feedlots and for common sense is you also built in there a 3-week, 21-day exemption for feedlots. And the reason you did was it wouldn't make sense otherwise because every fall, if anyone from rural areas, and you're all part of the ag committee, so you're obviously you're familiar, is when the manure is spread on the field, they're injected in the fall of every year. And they are injected not in the middle of the fields, but they're spread out evenly. And if you are injecting manure at the edge of a field, and you are subject to state standards, no matter how high or how low the MPCA sets them, you're going to be in violation. There's no way that there is a operator in this state who could, in the fall, spread manure pursuant to the MPCA's manure management plans and stay in compliance with these rules. So part of the law in 1997-2000 was a 21-day exemption. Again, that's applied. Everyone knows that it's been the law. But largely some folks being funded by different organizations outside of Minnesota, they're saying, no, only applies to Mr. Reitz and the MPCA, nobody else. And we can bring nuisance cases, Environmental Rights Act cases, regulatory compliance actions, except for the MPCA, against these facilities, even during the 21-day exemption period. It makes no sense at all. This bill is simply trying to clarify what is obviously was intended back in 1997 and 2000. And I say that with certainty because I've read through all the tapes through the legislative history to confirm this is what you intended. You wanted to quantify it back in 97, 2000. You wanted the MPCA to be the primary regulator to enforce it. And you wanted facilities. If you're going to, back in 97, 2000, one of the big things was you wanted to attract businesses, responsible businesses. You can't attract responsible businesses like this guy over here if they don't know what the standards are. If they're going to build a facility like these folks did from Iowa and they built a multi-million-dollar facility thinking that these were the objective standards which they meet and find out, well, no, those objective standards only apply if the MPCA is looking at you, but if your neighbor looks at you, it's a different standard. It's a subjective standard. And that subjective standard is based upon 9 members of a jury. That will not attract business to Minnesota. That will not endear well to the community. That's what we're seeking. It's just a simple clarification of 2 laws clear intention back in 97-2000 was quantify it, and that's what we want now. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Perry. Next up, we have Bron. I'm going to say this wrong. Scherer? Bron Scherer? Okay, great. State your name for the record and proceed.
Hello, Madam Chair. Bron Scherer. I'm a CPA by profession, also a partner with Paul Fitzsimmons, who has testified and you may know as one of our leading industry advocates and longtime multi-generational pork farmer from Blue Earth County. I grew up with Paul. I'm a partner and founder of Protein Sources in Mapleton, Minnesota. I also provide financial accounting and chief financial officer services to businesses throughout the state, but primarily focusing in livestock. I'm also a farmer. I own pigs. I own real estate similar to the unit that Mr. Perry referred to in Todd County. My firm also had a great deal to do with constructing that firm, managing it, and helping the Gorley brothers from Iowa construct that site in Todd County. We're proud of our record from the perspective of the livestock industry in terms of the jobs that it provides, good paying jobs. I've had the pleasure of living in all parts of the state, and it's relevant because I lived in downtown Minneapolis, I lived in Eden Prairie for 16 years, I've lived in three different parts of Northfield where I currently reside, beautiful and scenic Northfield, but I'm on the edge of town, and we have turkey barns right outside the city, and I'm right next to cropland, which gets manure applied to it, as Mr. Perry alluded. So I'm not an absentee farmer or member. But my point, and I'm here from my partner, Paul Fitzsimmons, who is out of town today, and I'm testifying in his stead, is just to say that we're, again, we employ about 280 people and through the managed farms that we have throughout the state and in other states. We take our environmental responsibilities very, very seriously. And in fact, my company was one of the leaders working with the MPCA back in the mid-90s. We volunteered to have testing done on our site near Good Thunder that I own a part of. So a lot of the odor testing and the other neighbor interfaces that were of concern, we take great pride in that environmental record and also have great appreciation for the professionals at the MPCA. We would like to continue to do business in the state. We have three similar projects that are in process in various stages of planning, and these aren't from large corporations outside the state. These are from farmers that may be crop farmers, may be diversified in other agriculture, that want to improve their situation. They want to improve the efficiency of their operation, and most importantly, they're willing to invest capital in the state of Minnesota to provide again these higher paying jobs and livestock. There's no, and I've been a CPA since 1981, been involved in a variety of businesses, both high risk and not. There is no greater risk industry than livestock in terms of the capital required and the various biological market, other risks, commodities, very, very high risk. And because of that, there are opportunities, but we want to be able to make sure that as longtime Minnesota residents that we're able to continue in Minnesota. But I can't, as a financial advisor and my partners as advising potential owners and us investing alongside to additionally invest in these sow units as our in our example, but it really applies to all livestock. We really need to look elsewhere unless we have the assurance that the rules are in place. And if we meet our rules and obligations under the MPCA, rules here in the state of Minnesota, that we will not have issues with respect to the neighbors. And we do take our neighborly responsibilities very seriously. We're in a very pig-dense area in Blue Earth County, Martin County, where I grew up on a farm. We understand what it's like and what it should be to live in harmony with our neighbors and yet provide a very key part of what goes on in the state of Minnesota economically. Appreciate the time and appreciate the time today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Scherer. Next up we have Pat Fitzsimmons. Pat is not here. All right. I did get an email from Paul, though, last night. So, next up we have Mr. David Prisler. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
First of all, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Prisler. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Pork Producers Association. We're based out of Mankato. On behalf of Minnesota's farmers who raise pigs for a living, we're in favor of passage of House File 582. I think that was already discussed by the previous two testifiers is that one of the things that's really key here is compliance, and compliance with laws that we have here in Minnesota. And so if there are farms that are not in compliance, then as we look at this bill, they would have no nuisance protection. Okay, this is really only for farms that are in compliance with all applicable state rules from a standpoint of whether it be light, hydrogen sulfide, noise, all of those kinds of things. If they're in compliance, they would get protection. And we think that that's something that's really important. So I just want to take a brief moment to talk about kind of really what's at risk. And the previous testifier talked about investment in the state. Mm-hmm. If we look at agriculture in general, agriculture generates about $21 billion worth of income that comes directly back to farmers. Of that $21 billion, 40% of it is livestock. And so the livestock is a huge part of our agricultural income here in the state. We're ranked number two in hog production in the U.S., number one in turkeys, seventh in dairy, 12th in cattle. So it's a big deal, and it makes a difference for rural communities. It provides well over 100,000 direct jobs on farms and in processing, and that doesn't include any of the indirect or support jobs that occur. Again, we believe that this bill provides some really common sense protections for farmers against suits that may be brought by plaintiff's attorneys, and we would encourage passage of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Priestler. So, members, we are running out of time, and so I think that we may end up coming back at 6 o'clock to pick up this bill. So in the order of time, I'm going to call up the next three testifiers, Travis Winter, Dale Schmeling, and Douglas Ayers. So these members did travel some distance, so we want to make sure that they get ample time, and when they are done testifying, I will open it up to questions for these three in case they cannot come back tonight at 6. Travis? Please state your name, first and last name, for the record, and proceed.
My name is Travis Winter, Madam Chair. Thank you. I just want to say that I am involved, actually, in a lawsuit. I am from Todd County. The reason I'm here today is I feel that this is my last choice or option for protection. I've gone to township board members. I've gone to our commissioners. I've gone to Soil and Water. I've placed calls to the pollution control. And no one, it doesn't seem like there was any other option for me at this point to proceed. And this thing was built 1,700 feet from my house. There's six neighbors all within a half mile of it. Every day you go outside and you're unable to do anything outside. I mean, it makes you sick, makes my nose burn, makes my eyes water. I can't even go outside and play with my children, enjoy my property. I mean, there's nothing I could do. I sat probably three quarters of the summer, this last summer, inside my house because it was just unbearable to be outside. So, any questions?
Well, we're going to go through the rest of the three, and then we'll call up. You're welcome. Thank you, Mr. Winter. Next up, we have Dale Schmeling. Please state your name and proceed. I see you have matching shirts on. Matching shirts with Mr. Winterdale.
We're not twins. My name is Dale Schmeling. I live in Westfield Township, Dodge County, Hayfield, Minnesota.
Proceed.
I'm a former feedlot operator, and I'm semi-retired now. And we live in an area, I'll give you a little background. 2 mile radius around our house, there are 34,600 pigs. 36,400 pigs. They've got me surrounded on three sides. You can't avoid the odor. It's impossible. I've talked to the township officers. I've talked to the county commissioners. and we can't get any results. And I guess I'm here to state the case to this. It's just almost unbearable. I could give you a statistic on what happened a couple years ago. There's a 2,400 hog unit, and this operator had about 20 acres of land that wasn't planted to crops. They came with a semi-tractor trailer system. It was not an applicator. They didn't inject the manure into the ground. They drove that tractor back and forth and spread it on 20 acres of land. Well, they didn't get the building empty. The next day they came back and they covered it again. They still didn't get it emptied. The third day they came back and they covered this 20 acres again. Three times they covered that land. The tracks from the tractor trailer semi were level full of liquid manure. That didn't soak in for 3 days. And the odor was unbearable. We just couldn't avoid it. Another thing that is a concern of ours, I'm semi-retired, and we restored our place to what it was originally. It's a little dairy barn, and I cleaned it all up, and we set it up to host weddings. Well, needless to say, the odor took care of that. We are no longer in business hosting weddings. It's if we can't get something done pretty soon. I've been a resident of Dodge County since 1959. We are going to be forced to move because we just cannot stand it. I've been on a farm all my life, and I do not look forward to moving, but we are not going to have a choice. I guess I have nothing further. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to try and answer.
Thank you, Mr. Schmeling. Next, we have Mr. Ayers.
Thank you, Chairwoman Franson, for giving me the chance to speak to the committee briefly on HF 582. My name is Douglas Ayers. I reside in Maple Grove. You probably wonder why I want to speak to you today about HF 582. I grew up with livestock on my parents' farm in Dodge County, the same county Dale Schmeling lives in, but I grew up on the north side of the county. And I own part of this farm today, and I visit the county multiple times each month. I'm not against agriculture, I'm not against animal agriculture, but I do not believe HF 582 is a good bill for Minnesota or its citizens. Dodge County in southern Minnesota is a heavy animal agriculture county. It has a population of just over 20,000 people, and we have 85,000 animal units in the county, and that's quickly approaching 100,000 animal units, the majority of which are swine held in large swine confinement barns. With 85,000 animal units in Dodge County already, our county produces the manure equivalent of 800,000 people.
Cool.
It's like a town. We have 20,000 people, but we're producing over 800,000, the annual equivalent manure production. So when our county recently approved a new 2,400-head swine barn, like the one near my in-laws, my father-in-law, Lola and Evelyn Traum of Blooming Prairie, Minnesota, have a grain farm. It's like moving a town of 7,000 people 1/2 mile away. That's how much manure that barn is going to produce. And manure is under nuisance law, too, not just odor. This facility will produce 1.1 million gallons of liquid manure and has to be spread on the topsoil in the nearby fields. Sometimes it's knifed in. Often it's just spread on the surface. Dodge County has five major watersheds that run out of our county, two flowing directly towards Olmsted County in Rochester, Minnesota, and one flowing directly at Maurer County in Austin, Minnesota, Cedar River. I worry about manure runoff from all of our swine barns into these watersheds with so much animal manure being produced. The manure pits and manure spreading creates a significant odor nuisance to neighbors who have to live by these facilities. My neighbors fought the initial permitting of a new swine barn project just northeast of our farm that was eventually approved by the county. A family friend, Scott Glarner, his wife and young child, lived less than a mile from this new project when it was proposed. Scott could not be here today, so he asked me to speak for him and for the neighbors and friends who fought this project. The fight was personal for him since his wife and child both were suffering from asthma. Despite very strong local opposition and with signatures from over 800 county residents who oppose this project, the county didn't care. They approved the swine barn anyway. You see, in Dodge County, on these feedlot issues, the county board is controlled by the large feedlot interests. The county has never denied a new feedlot permit to anyone for any reason. Later, it allowed an expansion. They put in a second barn, then a third swine barn went in. And this is typical in the county. Once an initial barn goes in, it's usually two or three that come behind it, a couple come behind it. Once the three swine barns were up, the farm owner-operator and his wife moved away. They moved throughout. They lived by the facility, but once they got their third barn in, they moved off the property so they don't have to live by the odor. Over time, Scott's son Jacob and his wife suffered tremendously from the odor nuisance for 5 years, but then they were forced to sell and move into town. Scott's son Jacob now is 14. He lives in town, not by the swine barns, and he is actually being weaned off his asthma medication, so there was a benefit by him moving in that sense. If the legislature approves HF 582, you will deny families like the Glarners the opportunity to file a nuisance claim against these large feedlot operators. The neighbors cannot recover huge windfalls if they file a nuisance claim. All they can recover is an abatement of the issue. So it's not like a class action where you can come in and get some huge class award. They can only recover, they can only force the feedlot operator to comply. That's all they can do. If the legislature denies this opportunity, you deny the neighbors their day in court. That's the last resort. They can go to the district court to force compliance. These are rural citizens who have already been marginalized on the front end due to the steamrolling of new feedlot applications in our county. And HF 582 would largely silence them on the back end. Once the facility is operating, you limit their ability to challenge the operator in the court of law. I believe this bill protects the powerful in our state, and it is unfair to the feedlot neighbors who have to live by these facilities. I urge you to vote against this bill. Are there any questions?
Mr. Ayers, I actually have one. If the agricultural property is already complying with what's in statute, what then taking the operation to court would solve that problem? What are they complying with, I should say?
Right. The issue, well, there's a couple things, I think. Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. One is the neighbor has to bring the action forth. They have to actually investigate and file a complaint with the county or whatever. And they have to try to take proactive action to catch them out of compliance. And I can only speak for Dodge County, but Dodge County is a delegated county under agriculture law, which means the county is the primary enforcement arm. It's not the MPCA. The MPCA largely stays out of the county unless there's an issue that's brought into them. So we depend on our local feedlot officer and our local county to protect from nuisance issues. And so I think there's an area here where the neighbors have to catch the person with a problem or bring it to the attention, and it's kind of a messy process. And I'm just trying to think the second part of your question, Madam. It was about the current law, right?
I guess.
Yeah.
That is correct, yeah. Mr. Ayers.
And so it puts there is a lot of legal burden on the neighbors to try to turn to their county for protection. And like I said, in our county, and I can only speak for our county, there's a lot of political pressure on the regulators. It's like these are large operators. They have a lot of political clout, and they do try to force compliance. And so the neighbors are kind of marginalized. I guess that's the term I would use. It's hard for the neighbors to deal with this because they feel that the county favors a large operator. But you have to prove them. You have to go through a legal process to prove that they're out of compliance, and then all you can recover is an abatement of the issue. I don't know if that answered your question.
Is there anybody else here who has traveled a long ways that would like to testify that may not make it back tonight at 6 o'clock? Oh, okay.
My name is Paul Sobosinski. I'm with the Land Stewardship Project. I probably will make it back tonight at 6 o'clock, but I do want to testify and had submitted my name, but I guess it got missed.
No, your name is here, sir.
Okay.
All right, I'm going to open up for questions for the three testifiers. And we have Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my first question would be for Mr. Ayers. So, Mr. Ayers, the state of Minnesota has some of the most stringent rules and regulations in the nation, and you're saying that Dodge County is a delegated county.
Correct.
And it is my understanding that you have federal guidelines, you have state guidelines, you have county guidelines, and then you have township guidelines. And the county guidelines can be more stringent than the state guidelines. Do you know, is Dodge County's regulations more stringent than what the state's are?
All right, Mr. Ayers.
Okay, that's correct. The county, I think, in some respects, not on the odor. I think they depend on the state guideline for the odor issue. The county has some setback boundaries and things like that they enforce on their local level, with regard to it's 1,000 feet from the neighbor's house. I was also going to say in the township, this particular township. Or a lot of the townships don't have local zoning, so they depend on the county and the state guidelines. The federal guidelines only pertain to the very large feedlots, and the federal guidelines are basically enforced. I mean, I think the biggest feedlots in the county are the federal government. They're nervous about the federal government, so they comply good. But there's a sweet spot that's in the middle where the state and the county enforces, and that's where the issue is that I see. It's in this area of that area of enforcement.
Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Ayers. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And Mr. Ayers, so with the federal guidelines and the state guidelines being more stringent than the federal guidelines, and in this case the county guidelines being more stringent than the state guidelines and the federal guidelines, are these facilities that you have issues with in compliance with all those guidelines?
Mr. Ayers.
Thank you. Again, I'll just step back. It's true that the state has established guidelines and that the county has established guidelines, but because Dodge County is a delegated county, the local enforcement officer is the primary enforcement officer of all these standards, the state and local standards. And we've seen in Dodge County that they get intimidated by the local feedlot operators, and so we don't think they always protect us, and that's why a lot of the neighbors feel marginalized, because they feel that it's the laws are not being enforced. The state MPCA will only come into our county when they're basically brought into the county by the county government. That's the only way they'll come in. They stay out. They only do a kind of a supervisory thing. They do have to do an annual feedlot report, and they have to turn in data to the state, and the state MPCA does audits. They come in and audit activity in the county, but the county is the primary enforcement arm, so we really depend on them to enforce these guidelines.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and thank you for that, because I do understand, the way I understand it too, you do not have to be a delegated county, and so this is a choice that Dodge County is making, and if there's some issues with that, they can turn to the PCA in order to enforce those issues. My second question, in your example, you talked about a family being forced to sell. Who did they sell their home to? Well, number one, were they able to sell their house? Who did they sell it to, and are they having the same issues?
Mr. Ayers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The family, they just had a small residential lot, and they were able to sell. I think that they had to sell at a discount price, but they were able to sell the property, and another person moved in and bought the property. So they were able to exit the house, but I don't think that it was a good value for them.
Representative Hamilton.
Madam Chair, the current residents in that home, are they having the same issues?
Mr. Ayers.
Sorry. Thank you. I think I'm not aware for sure if they are or not. I don't know. I don't think that it would be my understanding that they haven't filed a complaint with the county or anything like that, the new owner.
Representative Hamilton.
No, yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Ayers.
Thank you.
Okay, up next, we do have somebody that has traveled. If you'll please state your name for the record.
Laura Winter. I'm Travis's wife, and I just wanted to fill in a couple of things about our house, and we live 1,700 feet from the place in Todd County, and we actually just sold our house, too. We had been trying to sell it for 2 years. We had it listed at a price with a few different realtors. We had to reduce the price of our home significantly a couple times. So we finally did sell our house. And also I wanted to touch on when the facility was coming into our county. We talked with planning and zoning. My husband actually did research, found out about BioBark filters. Brought it to the planning and zoning. They had it in the conditional use permit and actually took it out, which would have helped with the hydrogen sulfide that's in the air. So we weren't sure. We might have been able to stay there if those would have been left on, but with the quality of life and not being able to go outside and having two small children, it's hard to send them outside when they don't want to go out when it smells outside. Our water quality, too, we were concerned about that. Water pressure, using so many gallons of things, affects our quality inside the house, not alone, just being outside the house. So I just wanted to share those few things, too. Thank you for your time, and I appreciate it.
Ms. Winter, I'm just wondering, you said you had listed your home at a price, and you were unable to sell it and had to reduce
that
price.
Right, and we actually had three people come look.
Was that home priced what the surrounding area was going? Was it priced higher?
I actually am an assessor for Todd County, so I kind of know what things are selling for, so we did. And with the realtor's help, they had comparables, too, that helped us set a price to start with. And then when we relisted it the second time, we took a significant drop in value, too, when we sold it. So. But, we just wanted to be able to enjoy our property that my husband actually had lived at before the facility had been built. So,
Ms. Winter, your location, in what direction is your house located, northeast,
we're
southwest?
Southeast. So we get the northwest wind. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep, thank you.
I'm going to open it up to questions again. Do we have any, Mr. Representative Bly?
Thank you, Chair. And I have a lot of questions. I'm not sure exactly where to start, but we had kind of a narrative laid out for us about what had happened, and I'm curious to know if we could have the MPCA comment on some of the interpretations or the changes. Is that possible?
Actually, Representative Bly, they are going to be back here tonight at 6 to testify, so we'll save those questions for then.
All right. Thank
so
you.
If there's any for those that have traveled, do you have Representative Bly?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Sobaninski, if you would like to come up and testify now. And please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Paul Sobaninski.
I work with the Land Stewardship Project, and I work with the Policy and Organizing Program of the Land Stewardship Project. LSP works on behalf of sustainable agriculture, agriculture that we believe that sustains the farmer, the community, and the environment, the whole idea of stewardship. We support more farmers on the land, raising livestock and raising crops. Besides state policy, we work on federal policy. We have a program works on community-based foods, farm beginnings, and now a program working on farm transitions. We have approximately 3,700 family memberships. A third of that is our farmers, a third is in rural, and a third is metro. I'm also, besides working for the Land Stewardship Project, I'm also a crop and livestock farmer from Wabasso, Minnesota. I've been raising livestock since 1976. I've had a confinement operation, and currently I converted that about 10 years ago when hog prices went down to $8, worse than the depression of the 1930s in which my grandfather farmed. I have a great deal of experience working with livestock. My current operation, I've now raising pigs for Nyman Ranch without antibiotics and in a deep straw system. The other experience I have is working in Redwood County. When the first onslaught of large livestock operations started to occur in the 1990s. In my area, two 1,200 sow operations were proposed, one of which was proposed to happen by Jackpot Junction. Concerned citizens got together and were concerned about what impact those operations would have. Those operations at that time were being proposed to be built with earthen basins. And ultimately, through the zoning powers that are at a county level, the proposal for those two operations got turned down because of the concerns that citizens expressed through the zoning process, through their county commissioners. Meanwhile, in the neighboring Hood County, Renville County, a number of large livestock operations put together by Val Adco went forward, and that narrowly passed at the county commissioner level. And from that point on, in that county, there was an onslaught of odor issues. Odor that affected people where these operations were proposed. I started working for the Land Stewardship Project in 1993, and so I had the opportunity to work with some of the neighboring residents. In particular, one of the pieces, and it's talked about here a little bit before, was the issue of hydrogen sulfide. And what was happening for one of the operators there was the issue of odor affecting family, I shouldn't say odor, actually the hydrogen sulfide is actually a gas, and their health was being affected. And so one of the pieces that resulted in work that we did in terms of making sure, and our organization since 1993 has worked to make sure that we keep strong local control so that townships and counties have the right to set higher standards than the state as it relates to the siting of livestock operations. Typical in zoning ordinances is the piece that says the idea of the zoning ordinance is to protect the health and welfare for the residents in the county and for the use and enjoyment of their property. And the reason I bring that forward, I think that's rather important. That's one of the pieces that, for example, some of the people in Renville County were not able to experience and did not get the results that they wanted at the local level. So some of those people were active with us and working at the state level in terms of getting legislation passed. In particular, at that time passed was hydrogen sulfide. And hydrogen sulfide is not necessary, it can be related with odor, but it's not necessarily an odor. It's a gas. It's a gas that can kill. It's also gas that over a long time can do harm to a person. And that's an important distinction to remember. Even though the state set a standard and has a standard set around hydrogen sulfide as saying to odor. Odor has a lot of compounds to it. And that needs to be thought about. So in terms of what happened eventually in Renville County, that it alleviated the problem some was also an issue that finally happened as it related to the hog industry in this state as a result of citizens, many farmers, our organization, other organizations. The state solved part of the problem by saying that livestock waste had to be contained, not in earthen basins. That's where a huge problem was. So that's one thing that happened. And today there isn't not as much uproar raised over the hog industry because of that situation. And also because the local control is still strong. And the what we see in Minnesota, because we have local control, and we also have some standards at MPCA that says if you're bigger than 1,000 animal units, you have to do an EAW, environmental worksheet. You see a lot of more hog operations that are put up, particularly finishing units, two at a time, rather than a concentration of four, which you'll see some if they go through the EAW process, but versus like the state of Iowa, where they do not have local control, where there's a concentration where you'll see 8, 9, 10 barns at a time, and people feel they have no rights, and they're strongly affected by it. I think Minnesota, by us keeping local control, and by some of the things we've done, have been smarter about it, so it's more dispersed and not concentrated, even though our organization does not necessarily believe that's the way agriculture should go. We believe there should be more farmers raising livestock and finding a way to be compatible with neighbors, getting along with neighbors, so that if a neighbor is out there, retires, he still can enjoy his property, even though the next person next door has livestock. And I think that's reasonable. The piece that I looked at in terms of this legislation that concerns me is, in terms of this legislation, is this exemption that's being looked at providing the largest livestock operations in the state, and I think that's a mistake. It also appears to me that these operations, proposed with this legislation, is going to undermine local control.
Mr. Sobinski?
Yes.
Thank you. I'm just wondering, do you have much more? Otherwise, we're going to come back at 5:45, and you can pick up right where you left off.
That's fine. I could do that.
Okay. No, members, sure. Do you have any objections to recess until 5:45? Okay. Seeing no objections, we will recess and come back at 5:45. Please just leave your things right where they are, and it'll... The pages will pick it up, but you'll get your information back. So we are recessed until 5:45. I'm going to call back up Mr. Sobinski. So if you'll come up and continue your testimony, sir. If you want to state your name, sir, for the record, and proceed.
I don't have the bill with me.
Could I just have an extra copy of the bill? I misplaced mine. Madam Chairman, my name is Paul Sobosinski with the Land Stewardship Project, and thank you again this evening for the opportunity to continue my testimony. I would like now to go into the some of the particulars of the bill itself that our organization has concerns with. In terms of the specifics of the bill, my belief, our organization's belief, is that under current law, the overwhelming majority of livestock operations
are already protected under current law. This proposed legislation is designed to apply to a current court case right now in litigation. Changing the rules while this is happening is just not right. This bill is taking away the rights of, in my opinion, is taking away the rights of public agencies and local units of government to speak to nuisance also. There is no real odor level at the state level. Hydrogen sulfide is a gas. Odor comes from lots of different compounds. This issue at the legislature, when this was looked at a number of years ago in terms of hydrogen sulfide, our organization was involved with people out in Renville County when the issue of hydrogen sulfide was a big problem. And this was prior to when Valco was in operation. And because at the local unit of government, they did not turn down this proposed operation, one of the recourses that our organization sought in conjunction working with our members in Renville County was working to get a state law passed as it related to hydrogen sulfide, which is a gas which can affect people's health. And one party in particular, that was the situation. And so we worked for that legislation. That was passed, and that's where a state standard was set as it related to hydrogen sulfide. Our members were involved first in working on a protocol in terms of getting that piece done, and worked with the MPCA at that time, and finally there was a state standard set as to hydrogen sulfide, because it is a gas, a deadly gas. It's not a real true measure of just odor. It can be associated, odor can be associated with it, but according to the National Academy of Sciences, there are 330 odor-carrying compounds. So odor can come from a variety of pieces. So hydrogen sulfide, as a test, as is proposed in this legislation, is not the best test, is not, quote-unquote, just an accurate test as it relates to odor. In our opinion, the way this legislation is designed, it sets up the situation where we believe it's going to create a situation of more bad actors. It's because it's allowing the exemption for the largest operations in the state. And so instead of seeing things like we're seeing now, at least where large operations are proposed and county units of government say from time to time, okay, put up trees. You need to take care of this issue of odor. Or other air abatement issues, you know, like biofilters. Instead of that happening, it's going to discourage that because you can get slipped by the state standard, in our opinion. In terms of the legislation itself, I'd like to bring you to the underlying language. The language above 1.16, where it says except as provided in paragraphs D and G, that is referring to smaller operations that currently are exempt. But after that, it says the provisions of subdivision, you know, do not apply to the largest facilities. You know, 1,000 animal units or more as it relates to pigs, or 2,500 head of cattle. And if you flip over the page and you look at the new underlying language, it puts in new provisions tying in what are, you know, so-called state standards. One of those, which is, for example, hydrogen sulfide. And so it's setting a standard, a bar, above, for example, what local units of government can set. In our opinion, this legislation looks at and negates the ability of townships and counties to do land use planning as it relates to this issue of odor. That's local control, and we believe that's not right. And we believe that the standards that we've set in this state that are different than other states like Iowa, local control, both at the county level and at the township level, has caused our livestock industry to be dispersed rather than concentrated, and that's an important provision to achieve. So that's the reason why we are opposed to this bill. I appreciate the opportunity to testify and would be open to questions.
Thank you. So, Mr. Sobieniewski? I'm so sorry. Okay, so what kind of, if it's not the hydrogen sulfide test, what type of test would you suggest to the body? How would you measure it, and exactly what would you measure? Because what I understand is there's over 300 chemicals that can make up an odor. And if I recall correctly, the MPCA is only able to measure the hydrogen sulfide.
That's what they're set up to measure. Local units of government very often set standards in their zoning ordinance that say common things like, you know, this ordinance is for the protection and welfare for the residents of the county, that a proposed operation should not affect the use and enjoyment of people's property. So counties do look at that. Townships can look at that. Very often that's deferred at a county level. And they go by what people say about what they hear, by their experiences, that type of thing. Some units of government look at the odor issue from pieces of research that's done at the University of Minnesota.
So if Mr. Sobieniewski, so if I get this correctly, it would be based on opinion of the neighbors.
It can be. I mean, it depends what the local unit of government makes the decision about how they're going to look at and evaluate, you know, odor, setbacks, all those kinds of pieces. They are typically what's done in a county or a township. They do land use planning. They study about how we should evaluate, how should we make it a determination as it relates to odor or other issues at a county level, and then put that in an ordinance and make decisions. Very often they have provisions in the county level that says if an operation is of a certain size or more, figuring where that size might be problematic, they call for a conditional use permit. They provide for the opportunity for local citizens and neighbors to come in when an operation like that is proposed. If it's over a certain size, the citizens have an opportunity to comment, and as well as the party that's proposing the operation, the opportunity to bring in conditions that may affect the situation, like. The ordinance says health, safety, and welfare of the residents of the county. There may be a party that's in close proximity to the proposed operation that is asthmatic. You know, and to the degree that is a health concern. So the idea is to hear that at the local level.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We've got members. We've got two on the list currently, three on the list currently, and then after those three are up, we're going to move on to the next testifiers because we have to wrap this bill up because we have the regent vote. Yay. So first up, we have Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, you said in your opening statement that you have a hog site. I believe I caught that right. And your hog site, are you mandated by law to be in compliance, 100% in compliance with all the rules and regulations, or are you exempt?
Mr. Chairman, in terms of my hog operation, I have a registered feedlot with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. That's on the record.
All right, Madam Chairman.
And to my knowledge, I mean, I went through this with them. I am in compliance, to my knowledge.
And Madam Chair, my question is,
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you referred to
You're talking about small farms that are exempt from the rules and regulations. Can you help explain that to the committee? Why are small farms exempt?
Well, this bill, when it was set up as it relates to nuisance, if an operation is in operation for 2 years or so, there's this rebuttable presumption that it's not a problem, and therefore they can continue to operate. And they do, you know, have to apply with the provisions of the nuisance law that sits there.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hamilton.
Yeah, it's my understanding that there is a provision in law where small farms are exempt from the feedlot rules and regulations in the event there's not cost share dollars to bring them up in compliance. And so that's where I was going with that. And Mr. Sobosinski, with your farm, and I'm assuming it's under the animal units as you brought forth in here, do you think that if I was your neighbor, that if you're in compliance in your farm, 100% in compliance as it's related to noise, as it's related to air quality standards, as it's related to hydrogen sulfide, do you think that I should be able to bring a lawsuit up against you and your farm in the event you are doing everything right and you're 100% in compliance? Do you think that I should be able to still be able to do that?
I think that the right should exist there for the public, for neighbors, to bring a lawsuit. You know, and that will depend on whether I'm in compliance or not. But that also would depend how I'm operating my farm. If I'm hauling manure down the township road and dumping half of it on the road, you know, that's not going to be acceptable. If I choose to haul manure on a day in which a neighbor is planning a graduation, that's just right across from my 80s, across from my neighbor, you know, that's not acceptable.
And Madam Chairman.
Representative Hamilton.
I'm sorry, Mr. Sobosinski, I didn't ask if you weren't in compliance. I asked if you were in compliance, you were operating your farm in accordance to the law, you know, your best management practices, seeing all your abiding by your manure management plans, et cetera, should I be able to bring a lawsuit up against you?
I believe that people who live in rural area, and whether it be a farmer or another citizen, if someone is causing a problem, they should have that opportunity. If I was doing something in my operation, you know, for example, with the issue of odor, if I was causing a huge problem of odor, that's affecting the use and enjoyment of people's other property. And that's where this has become such a difficult issue, is we now are creating this new exemption for the largest livestock operations and saying, if they go to these new state standards or these so-called state standards, they don't have to comply, for example, what my township or a county ordinance would say. It supersedes that. That's the way I understand that language. And I based that, my testimony, upon consultation with Farmers Legal Action Group, who did a memo with us, in terms of us asking the questions about what this law does and our concerns with that law. That was the basis for my testimony, for our organization to say accurately as possible what there is to say on and this issue.
Thank you.
Representative Hamilton, and then we got to move on to the other question.
I understand that. You know, my point was, and I don't know if the question was fully answered because there was some additional stipulations, if you will. My question was, in the event you have somebody that is 100% in compliance with all the rules and regulations, should somebody still be able to bring forth a lawsuit? And I come back to what I'd say, just because you're small doesn't make you good, and just because you're large doesn't make you bad. It comes down to the individual operators. And Mr. Sobosinski brought up about the Valadco. I know the new owners took ownership of that, and they worked with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and then it was the Attorney General, Mike Hatch.
and they shut down some of the earthen basins. They turned some into wetlands. It was monitored 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for an entire year, and it wasn't out of compliance. It was designed wrong initially, and so there's some reasons behind that. I'll respect the time. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, in response to that
Mr.
piece...
Mr. Sobolinski, then we're going to go to the next question. Okay.
The piece that I want to say is you're proposing in this legislation is new standards. Standards that are may not, in number of cases, are not as strong as what local standards might be. You're superseding those standards. And so some of the issues that were expressed here earlier today are not going to be covered by this. Now, we think that it's important that it's covered, that there's compatibility, that agriculture has compatibility with neighbors, whoever they are. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Sobolinski, and I will take... And I also agree with Representative Hamilton. I don't think you quite answered his question, but Representative Anderson, you have something to add?
Well, just a quick comment on the testimony. I don't think this bill proposes anything new. It's just saying if you're in compliance with what's already on the books in terms of MPCA standards, you're good to go. There is no new standards being proposed in this law. And if we need an additional standard for ammonia, for example, let's do that. But as of right now, this law, this proposed bill, does not add new standards.
And I would agree with you too, Representative Anderson. That's how I read the bill as well. Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair. And to the testifier. At different times in law with this sort of issue, my sense is there used to be what I would call more of a balance where, as an earlier testifier talked about a citizen or a neighbor who wants to bring a suit, they don't get a lot of money. They get the farmer to comply trying to remove the nuisance or the problem for them. And I think that in a way, that creates some balance for the people who live there. We shouldn't have a situation where the only recourse is that a neighbor has to move or leave. And I'm wondering, I guess, is it your sense that as we embrace these kinds of laws, that we're moving further and further away from that kind of balance where a citizen can interject or can say, look, my life is being disrupted by this. My children who have asthma are being affected by this. I would like to have the farmer do something to change that.
Mr.
Sobolinski.
Representative Bly, my sense is this legislation is moving us away from there. It's moving us away from there in the sense that people's ability, both in case of attempting to bring a private suit, that's making it nearly impossible to be able to do that to protect their property rights. I personally would call that a takings of property rights. When I heard the testimony here today, when a party felt they had to sell their home because they no longer could live there. I also think that one of the strongest deterrents of keeping livestock operations spread out in this state and not concentrated, like in Iowa, has been the power of local units of government, townships and counties, to do land use planning. And when you look at this bill, it cites section on 2.1, it cites section chapter 394 and 462, and both those chapters involve land use planning at townships and counties. And so this legislation is going to set different standards and affect the ability of those townships and local units of government to have the kind of say, set a stronger standard to address the odor issue that we heard today, for example, that people experience. Because right now it ties it to just hydrogen sulfide.
And you mentioned that you had gotten some information from the legal action group, the Farmers Legal Action Group. I don't know who we're hearing from after this testifier, but it would be good, I think, to hear some of that information before we make a decision about this. Is it possible to have, if there's someone here, to speak to that, to speak to some of the findings in that?
Well, Mr. Bly, we have Regents tonight. We have two more testifiers. We have plenty of discussion, it sounds like, so not really.
Okay, well, I'll do my best to read through it myself then.
Sorry.
Okay. That's all right now.
Representative Lewick?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got two questions. One is, could a testifier provide the specific ordinances, local ordinances, that this bill will nullify or somehow destroy or usurp? It's really easy, yes or no. Can you provide those in writing?
Well, I certainly don't have those along, and I think if you wanted to
In the interest of time, Madam Chair, in the interest of time, yes or no?
It's not a yes or no question. That's a question you should have the Association of Counties and Townships before asking them.
And Representative Hamilton has a quick question.
Madam Chair, in a similar what I was, maybe this is for the author, could you point to the language where it does supersede or weaken local control? Can you point to that so that we can, myself and others, can see where it weakens local control?
Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton.
Representative Anderson.
I don't believe it does.
All right. And Representative Johnson, quick question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is a question along those same lines. I'm also, I picked up on the testimony about the local control. And if I recall, I just need to learn. When a hog barn is established, there's a permitting process to establish the barn, I would assume. Is that correct? I might be asking the author here.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, to my understanding, the local permitting is more of a zoning issue, of where to put the building, do you want trees up, that kind of thing. Again, to my way of thinking, the local zoning would be more of a location issue for where the barn should be built.
Representative Johnson.
Then, Madam Chair, and Representative Anderson, let's assume that, you know, putting up the trees, there's some conditions on the zoning requirements for the placement of the barn. Does this supersede those conditions?
Representative Anderson.
I would say no.
And maybe the same
Representative
question for
Johnson.
The testifier. Would it supersede the conditions for the zoning requirements?
Mr. Solbitsky.
Madam Chairman, Representative Johnson, my sense about, and I think it goes back to what the zoning laws normally state in the county, is they require more than just the siting of the operation, but the zoning order speaks to particular provisions about the health, safety, and welfare of the residents in the county. And normally in a conditional use process, the zoning law, if I had a Redwood County one here, I'd be able to read it from you, but would say something like, this should not be passed unless it meets these kinds of standards. So it's not just the issue of location, it's about the set of standards that the county has set. And normally those standards are done after a very thorough study. For example, our county brought in farm organizations, citizens, and others concerned about putting together the kind of standards our zoning ordinance would have to make sure that it covers all the aspects. And so typically a county, depending on what their ordinance is, some are strong, some are weak, as to what they speak to as the decisions that could be made by that local planning and zoning board. And that has a big effect about the operations that are cited here in this state. And it's been an important part of history. And I really would plead with the committee to really hear the issues of this bill. I mean, Mr. Stephen Carpenter from FLAG, who we worked with on this, is present here. He has worked with, he can cite specifically the concerns and issues as it relates to this bill and how this negates the rights of townships and counties.
All right, Mr. Sobolinski, thank you. Representative Anderson, you had something to add?
Just a quick comment again. If the local county organization sets conditions for a permit, they would not normally grant the permit until those conditions are met.
Correct. Okay, going next is Joel Carlson in the audience. All right, Joel, you can come up. And then followed up, we will have Jeff Smith from the MPCA, if you want to come up as well. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice, making my second excursion into the Agriculture Committee, and I'll try and make it my last for the session. Our organization does have some concerns about the bill, and Madam Chair, I wanted to say thank you to you. That was thank you for taking those witnesses from out of town early today. I know they appreciate it. They weren't my witnesses, but I know they appreciate it, and thank you for doing
You're
that.
Welcome.
I would tell you that on behalf of our association and our members, some of whom have handled these kinds of nuisance claims, we do believe that the bill in front of you is a substantial, however well-intended, departure from the existing law. And it's not in the bill before you, but if you look at the very first section of 561, the chapter that you are amending, it defines what a nuisance is. And a nuisance is anything that is injurious to your health, indecent or offensive to the senses, or an obstruction to the free use of property so as to interfere with the comfortable enjoyment of life or property. That's a nuisance. And that law has been in place, I believe, since 1905. And what happens in these cases, a citizen or a group of neighbors who have tried in vain to get abatement of a problem facility, their only remedy right now under law is to bring an action in court to try and abate the nuisance. And it isn't where they want to be. It isn't where they want to end up. They prefer to just go about living their lives and not having to be in court over these types of claims. But in most instances, this is their final and only remedy. And, you know, we have two types of nuisances in Minnesota. They're both impacted by the bill, and I do think it has an impact on local units of government, because you're saying that if a operator meets these standards, they will not be deemed as a matter of law, not an issue for the jury, but as a matter of law, they will not be deemed a private nuisance, that's me as a landowner or the neighbors, or a public nuisance, which is an action by a county prosecutor, or the attorney general, or a city attorney to bring an action to enforce a permit condition. And you need to know that compliance, Representative Hamilton, to get to your question, compliance is not the standard for nuisance. You can have operations, whether it's a bar that's a nuisance or an adult bookstore or any number of things that are operating in compliance with their zoning or permit conditions, that can still be a public nuisance or a private nuisance. It does not have to be illegal conduct. And I can tell you the biggest concern that our association has is that we do not have in Minnesota a standard for odor. Minnesota used to have an odor standard. It was measured by odor units, and it was repealed in 1998. And so when we talk about being in compliance with odor standards on lines 2.14 and 2.15, you need to know that that is a false promise for neighbors. And I'm happy to share with the committee, but if you just go to the MPCA website on their odor policy, it says right on their website that the MPCA does not have an odor rule. And sometimes odors can be an indication that there's a pollutant in the air, but in many cases, odors is detectable even when a company is within its emission limits. And so what's happening here in these cases, and they're rare, is that the standard of hydrogen sulfide does not address the issue of odor. And so these residents have brought a claim to try and abate that nuisance. And the last point that I'll make, Madam Chair and members, and I appreciate the important task you have tonight, is that it is rare indeed when the legislature has a bill that addresses pending litigation in the way that this legislation does. In four different places, this affects pending cases that are currently going on in court, and it is rare that that this legislature has done that, particularly when you have people that are litigating over their property rights and diminution of value and health concerns that these citizens have brought forward. I don't have not dealt with any of them. I've heard their testimony here today. But that is what these cases are about. And so, you know, I would urge you to at least consider that, because really this is the last resort for your constituents when they do not have the ability to get compliance or abatement from local government, the state government, or even the Clean Air Act or the Clean Water Act. This is their last tool, and it's our belief that this completely takes it away. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for that point, Mr. Carlson. That is my number one concern about this bill as well, and for members who do not know, it's on lines 2.3 to 2.6. Mr. Carlson, could you tell me, is there any state in the union that has such legislation?
Madam Chair and members, I would be surprised if every state didn't have a statute that governed nuisance activity. I would be surprised. I have not done an exhaustive search, but it is, I think, could be even a common law remedy that we had at statehood. When you are interfering with my health, use, and enjoyment of my property, we've had a statute on it for since the Capitol was built in 1905, and I would be very surprised if that isn't a similar policy in most states.
Well, Mr. Carlson, I was actually specifically speaking to like the bill in front of us. Is there anywhere in the union that has a similar legislation?
Madam Chair, I don't know the answer to that. I can do some research on that before this gets to another committee. I was here, actually, when they adopted the first part of this in 1994. It was one of the first bills I worked on for the Association for Justice. I was here in 97, and I know that they didn't amend the law as it relates to nuisance when they did put in some different standards as it relates to cleaning and the hydrogen sulfide standard.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, can you help me understand, or where does it state specifically that this will take away local control, that it will supersede or weaken local control? Help me understand that.
Sure. Madam Chair and members.
Mr. Carlson.
Oh, sorry, Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair and members, as I read the language, I think when you make a statute that indicates that if a facility is in compliance with the standards you've laid out in this bill, and we already know that being in compliance is not the standard for nuisance, and you tell a local unit of government that they cannot bring a public nuisance action against a facility if they meet these standards, I believe that you are having an impact on the ability of local units of government to police facilities within their jurisdiction.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll try to ask the question this way. We have delegated counties, and even townships for that matter. Right. In the event we're a delegated county and we set our own standards as it pertains to livestock facilities, siting, how does this bill here supersede our regulations that we passed to regulate at the local level?
Or Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair and members, I'm quite familiar with the delegated feedlot permit program, but they can't delegate the authority that they don't have. And the MPCA does not have authority as it relates to odor. And so even though it is a delegated permit authority to the local unit of government, and many of them have it, the MPCA can't delegate an authority that they do not have, and they do not have a policy as it relates to odor.
And with that, thank you, Mr. Carlson. And we are going to move to the MPCA now. So if we could have Jeff Smith up. If you'll please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Galen Reitz. I'm the director of the Watershed Division. I think we had listed the wrong person, so
sorry. So we are speaking to who?
Galen Reitz. I'm the director of the Watershed Division at the PCA. The feedlot program resides in my division. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we have a few concerns with this bill, primarily in terms of, again, the management of odor, and then in terms of the potential fiscal impact that this could potentially have on the agency in terms of monitoring we may be expected to do. So just let me give you just a little background context. As you've heard before, odor is over 300 gaseous compounds, and that's been measured in various animal systems. And the PCA does not regulate odor. The PCA does regulate hydrogen sulfide, and we do require odor management plans for large feedlots. We manage the permitting for the facilities that are over 1,000 animal units. And where we have complaints, we do monitoring for hydrogen sulfide. When we get complaints, I think it's probably important to note that hydrogen sulfide, we do have standards for also ammonia, and hydrogen sulfide, it's because there are known health effects, and it's potentially lethal at high levels. I think one important fact to recognize about hydrogen sulfide, and when we monitor a facility, we monitor the facility at the property line, and so we're really we're measuring ambient levels of hydrogen sulfide in the air around that facility. And I think the point I want to make is that's different than receptor monitoring. We do not monitor at somebody's home or in their home, which is a different situation and condition. So I think that's really an important distinction. The other thing that I wanted to share is, and this occurred to me after the hearing this morning, that I remembered that we did have odor rules. They went into place in 1969. In 1986, some national standards changed, and we just And essentially, the methodology that had been proposed, it was like a six people on a panel would go out and have a discussion of whether they thought there was odor or not, was kind of the concept behind it. As a national kind of methodology, in 1986, that was no longer recognized as a useful tool. So in 95, we proposed a different odor rule, and nobody liked it. And so the rule did not go forward, and so then in 1998, we repealed the rule. And I think what's probably important to know about that repeal is that when we repealed it, we kind of did it on the basis of two things, that we didn't have the tools to be able to really regulate odor, three things. Secondly, that we thought that in situations, local units of government could maybe do a better job. And then thirdly, that private parties had another remedy, and that was nuisance court action. So that was one of the reasons we repealed the rules that were in place at that time. So that's kind of some context and background as far as the agency's role in this. I could tell you a little bit about how we do monitoring if you're interested in that, but I know you're short on time, so I'll let you decide that. I think just in terms of conclusions, I think one of our concerns is the way this bill is written and the fact that we do the statement of are they in compliance or not kind of puts us back in the middle of the odor debate in terms of a private party and the feedlot owner. I think the other thing we recognize is that monitoring really only establishes what the hydrogen sulfide levels are during the time you're monitoring. It doesn't guarantee what the future will bring in terms of hydrogen sulfide levels. And then I think our third concern is just the potential costs that if it turns out that we're expected to do the monitoring, monitoring for hydrogen sulfide at a facility is expensive.
Mr. Reitz, could you, in regards to the one of the lawsuits deals with the property in Todd County, at any time was there any complaints on that? And if there was, what was your findings?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, in the last 4 years, we've had about 35 complaints relative to odor. We log them, so we keep track. And 12 of those were at one facility, 6 were at another facility, and then the rest were spread around the state. In that time, we had one complaint from Todd County. It was in October of 2013, and we went out and investigated, and the day we were there, we used a Jerome meter, which is a mobile testing device, and there were not problems on that day.
Thank you, Mr. Reitz. Representative Bly.
Yes, thank you, Chair. And first let me just say that, you know, I did want to ask a question earlier when the trial lawyer was up. He made mention of practice in the legislature where we don't pass legislation or attempt to pass legislation that affects pending cases. And I can actually speak for having carried bills that could have affected pending legislation. I was always told that I needed to put in language that would prevent that, that would say this particular provision does not affect pending cases. And I think this is serious. It's not something just to be ignored or not talked about. And I find it very troublesome that in this bill it mentions it 4 times, that it does, that it would affect pending cases. So that I find troublesome. And to the testifier, you mentioned a little bit some questions that I had about kind of the narrative that we were told this morning about how we got to this situation where there was this compromise or alleged compromise about having hydrogen sulfide be the measure to establish this. And I have a couple questions around that. And, you know, you mentioned a little bit just now when you were talking about hydrogen sulfide. I understand hydrogen sulfide is a gas that, you know, say you have a hot day, that gas is going to go up, right? I mean, and so would that affect the measurement? And how long do you have these measuring instruments out and operating to collect data?
Madam Chair, members,
Mr. Reitz.
The first question as far as how does hydrogen sulfide gas work, it can be fairly complex. One of the things that we've observed is in the summer during hot weather, during very calm, those calm kind of August dog days of summer, hydrogen sulfide will basically rise, and when it cools down at night, that cloud, if it hasn't moved off, can come back down. And so that's why when we do monitoring for hydrogen sulfide, essentially to be confident in the results, we monitor for a season from May until October. Our monitors continuous air monitors are really only valid above 32 degrees. So it's basically May to October, and we measure 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and we put out 2 to 4 monitors depending on the facility, and it's the monitors are sited on the perimeter, on the fence line of the land of the facility. And so and you know, some days are fine, other days there are problems. We had one facility a few years ago that over the course of the summer had 400 exceedances of the hydrogen sulfide standard. The summer previous, that same facility had about 200 exceedances. So it varies depending on the situation, the weather, and a number of factors.
Representative Bly.
And you mentioned concerns about the cost. How much does it cost to do these sightings? And then I guess I would anticipate that if one farmer sort of gets this exemption from other kinds of nuisance suits, wouldn't you anticipate having a lot of farmers come forward and say they'd like to have you come out and make, you know, excuse them from any kind of nuisance suit?
Madam Chair and members, the monitoring setup, the cost is about $15,000 per setup, and we use 2 to 4 at each site, and they are placed out there, and then every 2 weeks we have to send a staff person out to download the data, to maintain the system, make sure that it's functioning, and recalibrate it. So it does get expensive, and then to analyze the data to understand and decipher what it actually means. The second part of your question I've just forgotten.
Representative Bly.
I was asking, would you anticipate that other farmers, if they see that this is a good way to exempt themselves from nuisance suits, that they might ask that you come and check out their hydrogen sulfide?
Madam Chair, members, in the past we have always responded to complaints. If we find enough reason to put the monitors out, then we do. And we have always covered that cost out of the agency budget. So that's why, yes, we are concerned that if people see this as a way to establish a safe harbor, that we might get many requests for monitoring to be done at various facilities. In the industrial world, we always charge the facility to pay for the monitoring. Either they contract for it or they reimburse us for the cost. But in the agricultural world, we have always covered the cost.
Okay. Representative Bly, real quick, and we're running out of time.
Well, Representative Anderson, I would just really strongly encourage you to change the language of this bill as it moves forward so that you're not affecting pending cases that are in court right now.
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative, this bill has several more stops, and we will do what we have to do to make the bill palatable. Yes.
Thank you. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's interesting. I do have one question for the testifier. You're talking about hydrogen sulfide. And back in the 90s, we referred that to the feedlot wars. And during that time, we purchased 2 Jerome meters. And we went around, we were checking our own farms and stuff, making sure we were in compliance. Then we bought the Jerome meters up here because there was some testimony going on. And we sat at a bus stop, and we went down on Plato Boulevard. And the area here in St. Paul was out of compliance on hydrogen sulfide. Then we went and we brought in infrared equipment, rented it from Atlanta, and set it up on 3 different municipalities, their sewer system. And they were out of compliance continuously. You brought something up about hydrogen sulfide being measured on the property line of the farm, and then you went on to the home. Do you think we should address the homeowner, and should we move that from not being measured at the property line of the farm, but move it to measure the hydrogen sulfide level in the home of the people who have the complaint?
Mr. Reitz.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, what I believe is there's a difference between what we regulate with ambient at the fence line, and what would be a nuisance condition at the receptor's site. And I think those are two different things, and that should be recognized.
All right. Thank you. And we are going to move now to Patrick Hines from the League of Minnesota Cities. Patrick around? Great. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Patrick Hines with the League of Minnesota Cities. I'll be very brief since we're running out of time. The League does have some concern with the breadth of some of the language, in particular the new language on lines 2.3 to 2.6, that's new paragraph D. That language is very broad, and under current law, there is an exception for local units of government to bring public nuisance actions under 60974. While unusual, those types of nuisance actions do represent sort of the last recourse that a community might have if they feel there's a nuisance that has gone unchecked. And by adding that new language on page 2, we feel that the ability of a community to bring such an action would be severely limited. And that's our primary concern with the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. I share your concerns. And now, does anybody else wish to testify in favor or against House File 582? All right. Any members have any closing questions? Representative Bly, did you want to ask that one question that I cut you off from?
No, I did ask the question, but I just would encourage in future committees that the testimony that I had hoped we might get from Stephen Carpenter will be allowed in other committees. I think it's important to. I think he's done some good work on an analysis of the bill, and I think it would be helpful to have that heard and have it on the record. Thank you,
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, we didn't preclude anybody from testifying at this hearing. I didn't hear that he wanted to. We had numerous testifiers, and if anybody in the future wants to testify, they will be allowed to testify.
Representative Bly.
Representative Anderson, I did ask if there would be time to have him come up and give his testimony, and I was told there wouldn't be time.
That was my fault. We have a couple minutes if he wants to come up, and you can ask your question, Representative Bly.
Very well.
Mr. Carpenter, I hate to tell you, but we are running out of time, so if you could just state your name for the record, and we'll proceed.
My name is Stephen Carpenter.
And Representative Bly.
Yes, I thank you, Chair, and to the testifier. I was curious what you might add to the discussion that you heard earlier about local control and about the taking away of local control. And in your analysis of this bill, does this bill affect the ability for counties and townships to have some control over what happens with this?
In my reading, it does, and that takes place because, as the statute reads right now, the essentially this Right to Farm Act that we have creates two exceptions where in one of them a city or locality can pursue a public nuisance, and that's irrespective of the Right to Farm law. In other words, farms get protected, but one protection they don't get is if a city or locality seeks to remedy a public nuisance. A second place that farms don't get protection from at present is regarding zoning and planning. And so even though we have a good Right to Farm law, right now, if there's a zoning or planning issue, or if there's a public nuisance issue with a city or locality, the farm does not get protection from nuisance. Under this statute, those two provisions go away. So that if this was passed as it reads now, even if a city felt that there was a public nuisance, it could not pursue that action based on sort of these specific changes. And similarly, the zoning and planning authority would be limited as well.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. And now I'll ask once again if anyone else wishes to testify in favor or against House File 582. All right. Seeing none. Representative Anderson, do you have any closing comments?
Just quickly, Madam Chair, I also visited with the township lobbyist, and we're going to be working on a concern he has as well. But I move that House File 582 be referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices.
All right. Representative Anderson renews his motion that House File 582 be referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All those opposed say no.
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 All right, the motion prevails, and committee adjourned.